everyone. Today I'm here with Matt Burns, founder and chief innovation officer at Bento HR. I have known Matt personally, and we had lunches and a lot of discussions around how he's using big data and technology to enable organizations in the HR field. And he has more than 20 years experience in HR, being a leader. And you traveled and spoke on HR extensively in Europe and South America. And your team actually won multiple awards. I think it's 2017 and 2018, the technology innovation in HR, and also the Canadian HR Team of the Year. So Matt, thank you for spending some time with me here today. And let's dive in, like, you know, with all the COVID situation that's happening here. What's happening in your life? Like, how did that change the HR world, or where do you see it's going?
So some big questions. First off, thank you so much. It's great to see you again. I've missed our lunches, so it's great to connect and just have a conversation, even if it is over this technology medium. And I think that's a really good microcosm for where I think we're all going, which is that we're all slowly, or not so slowly, coming to the realization that the world has just changed. And that we and our teams and our organizations need to change on the other side of that. I've made a lot of kind of sweeping proclamations throughout my career. The ones that didn't go very well, you don't hear a lot about. This one, COVID-19, nobody saw, at least I didn't see a pandemic coming. But what the consequence of it for me in terms of what I do with most of my time is that it has accelerated the impetus for digital transformation. And I use that term broadly because I think it means different things to different people. So for organizations, it could mean the adoption of technology. It could be for individuals, the adoption of analytics and data. Mm-hmm. It could be trying to achieve a synergy between your strategy, your technology, your data, and your processes. Organizations now no longer have the luxury of saying that our business runs 9 to 5, Monday to Friday in this physical work site, and we don't have a contingency plan for remote work. We don't have a contingency plan to be able to procure talented freelance workers from around the world to augment our resource base. They don't have the ability to say that we're not going to make preparations to ensure business continuity when we have a recent example of when that was placed in threat. Our biggest challenge in terms of growing our presence in the market 6 months ago was that we were fighting against inertia. We were fighting against the idea that we were selling a future that was looked like this, but that was 10 years down the road. And now COVID-19 has created it and put it in everyone's front lap. And we're finding ourselves helping organizations try and blend the more technical aspects of running an organization and trying to make it more human-centric. Because as you know, you can have both. And that's something that I've been very passionate about for my entire career, is this blend of technology, data, strategy, and human centricity. If you are intentional about using the technology and the data in your company in that way, then you can have massive effects on creating healthier workplaces that people thrive and have success and want to come to and feel good about. And as you know, for the majority of us, that's our reality. We spend most of our waking hours thinking about operating in or talking about work. And if I can help make workplaces even incrementally more satisfying for employees at scale and do it globally, then that is a significant achievement that we're trying to wrap our heads around.
Yeah, I see that you are very passionate about HR, and it comes with a lot of challenges too. Like, I know you work with some huge Canadian organizations as head of HR. A lot of the requirements, like, how did you approach that? Like, did the teams have some compliance with the current technology, and then you start exploring like what else you can do? Like, how did it all start for you?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think the cool thing, and I say the word cool with full understanding that right now we're in the midst of a global pandemic and it's a tragedy for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. In amongst all that, I find myself in a very privileged position and having lots of time and space to be able to reflect upon my life, my business, my organization, and how we want to show up in the world. And where we've come back is that a lot of the things that I was struggling with and trying to put solutions against in the corporate world are exactly the same problems people are facing now, but they're facing them on somebody else's timeline, not their own. So when I was leading transformational projects, we were restructuring companies, changing business units, mergers and acquisitions, massive technology projects. but we were doing it on a company schedule. We had a budget, we had resources allocated to it, we had ROIs attached to the project, and we had a runway. Mm-hmm. COVID-19 created its own timeline and forced people to put that on their agenda. And I'm sensitive to the fact that that is a very different energy that you bring to a very large project. You know this from your background. Technology or data or any of these systems types processes are not about the actual technical tools themselves. It's all about the human side of change. Mm-hmm. So what I've found through my experience is that you need to be really clear about the problems you're trying to solve. And I've never walked into a perfect organization, and my company isn't the exclusion. We have challenges that we operate with every single day. And if you're clear about those challenges, and then you work to rally the right resources and tools to be able to solve for them, then your digital transformation strategy becomes more clear. And let me give you a couple different examples. If I'm running an HR department and my team is spending the majority of their day reconciling spreadsheets, I have a problem, because not only is that work not satisfying and is not enriching to the people doing it, it's actually a poor use of finite resources, because the economics are such that I can get an AI-enabled algorithm to do the work faster, more accurately, and for cheaper than paying somebody to do the work internally. And that's a harsh thing to say, but it is a reality in today's economics, because when you're having to choose between paying people to do that kind of work, it comes at the expense of other investments you have to make in the organization, which could ultimately make you stronger, or make you more resilient, or make you deliver better results. So what I work to do is try and find the efficiencies within organizations that we can achieve through automation, through technology, through data, and then help them redeploy their resources elsewhere in the organization to drive top line, so that we can get focused around where the humans are actually spending their time and where they have unique value propositions that machines aren't well suited to do, whether it's things like creativity or emotional intelligence, leadership. Like, you, at this point in time, technology has not been able to automate those things for us. I would much rather put human beings in those areas and leave the reconciliation of checklists with chatbots. So that's what we do in organizations. We try and strike that balance between freeing up resources to be able to do the work and helping companies operate more effectively, which ultimately is in service to creating a more stable and more healthy workplace, which is great for employees that are in those organizations and great for our broader economy. And as I mentioned before, if we can create more stable, more healthy workplaces, everybody wins.
Yeah, it's all about caring for the teams and how you empower them to do their job, and also how do they communicate with the company. And that is pretty much a role of HR, right? Like, there's a lot of mental health aspect of it, how these things work as well. Have you seen any or expecting any changes in the way how they're working as big companies? Because I know a lot of companies have like minuscule budgets for HR. They invest a lot in a lot of other things, but when it comes to HR, it's always been less than what is needed. How do you see that like changing moving forward?
I don't. I see it getting worse. So I think it's even more important that HR people get stronger about building business cases that make sense. And I had the great fortune of working mostly in organizations that were very resource conscious. And as a consequence of that, I never had the luxury of having a operating budget that increased year over year in my entire career. It always went down. And I never had the luxury of being able to build a business case on upside. I always had to prove that I was going to have hard savings somewhere else to fund the investments I would make somewhere else. So because of that, I learned that constraints drive innovation, and we were able to get more creative with how we work with projects to do what I just mentioned, which is we didn't just restructure to lose headcount. We restructured and redeployed. Mm-hmm. So we actually, in some cases, saw a net increase in payroll or a net increase in headcount because we reallocated resources around the organization to better align them to the things that actually drove business results. So in that context, we've just been really intentional about linking those things together and being a bit more thoughtful about how you build a business case that speaks to driving incremental value. And I'll give you one of my tricks. So this is one of my, CHRO tricks that I learned early on in my career. My interests are in service to, as you mentioned, maintaining the culture of the organization. And that looks like mental health. It looks like skills. It looks like operational continuity. It looks like compensation. It looks like diversity and inclusion. It looks like leadership in the organization. There's a number of things that HR has now kind of absorbed as businesses have become more evolved. Mm-hmm. The reality is that the macroeconomics of an organization predicate that you spend a significant amount of time and energy into your resources, especially your human resources. Yeah. And the challenge is that traditionally the investment has been limited to salary and occasionally to benefits and to bonuses. And organizations went, well, we've done this. So that's the investment we're making. Now we want to extract the value from that in an exploitative model, and we're going to achieve economies of scale by squeezing down the price point as a function, or the cost as a percentage of revenue, and that's how we're going to have success in the market. And that worked really, really well 20 years ago, 30 years ago, certainly 50, 60 years ago. The model has now changed, and businesses have become more innovative, and they make decisions faster, meaning the amount of time it takes to make a decision in a traditionally waterfall type organization is too slow for an organization now, because things are happening at hyper speed. And now, especially in a post-pandemic world where the whole global economies have gone through a reset, it's even more imperative to go fast. So in light of all that, you're looking at trying to strike that tension between going quickly and also preserving the organizational culture, because the ironic thing about change is that as a consumer, I want change to go as fast as possible because I want innovation. But as an employee, I don't want change to go very fast because I want my workplace to be stable. But those two things can't coexist, right? I can't have innovation in a consumer context, have a slow workplace unless I've chosen to work outside the consumer economy. So I'm mindful of a whole bunch of different variables that exist in today's world, and that as a CHRO, I have to be mindful of the macroeconomic principles of an organization and be able to build business cases that leverage the resources that we have in service to the broader organizational performance, and not simply you view salary as a cost center, but use it as investment and determine what's the return you're getting on that investment. And if it means you spend a bit more money in training and development or diversity and inclusion or employment branding to be able to extract more value from that, That's what you were able to do. And my experiences have shown me that most organizations have those opportunities. It's just about looking into the right places.
It's just like, you know, people doesn't know it exists, right? And then once they realize this can be measurable in a tangible way, you can say it ROI, but that's something probably a lot of organizations start seeing in the last 5-10 years. And I think moving forward, they will even do more. And this is where your Bento HR provides advisory services and workshops and HR training to the companies, right?
Yeah, we understand that digital transformation is a complex and multifaceted issue, that it includes both technical elements as well as cultural elements. And we understand that it's a heavy lift for any organization of any size to undertake this kind of analysis and ultimately the work to go through it. We also understand that there's an incredibly compelling value proposition to going through the work. So we try and make it as easy as possible for organizations to get from point A to point B. And we provide the services that they need to be able to think through how we customize a journey for them so that we can balance being available to them, but also not being intrusive, to delivering change at the pace at which is challenging and innovative, but also doesn't overwhelm them from their core business. And that we can create bespoke opportunities with them. If they're looking for a technology enablement and procurement, we can help them with that. If they already have an existing technology stack and they want to squeeze some additional ROI out of it, we can help them do that. If they want to better leverage their analytics in service to predictive capabilities and trying to avoid risk as opposed to playing KPI whack-a-mole and reacting to problems, we can help them do that. So we go in and we understand the organization's problems, and then we curate and customize a solution for them. This is where we're different than traditional consulting, and where traditional organizations and new ones are different. From a consulting perspective, we don't have templates. So yeah, we move into an organization on the basis of what is the problem we're trying to solve, and then we help you solve the problem, and we deliver the metrics throughout the entire engagement to demonstrate the impact of our action, and we stand behind the work that we're doing. So the organization constantly has visibility to the impact that they're having working with us.
Yeah, it's amazing like how much you can accomplish using technology and big data and innovation. I'm glad Bento HR is leading the way. And I have other question right here. I was always inspired by your purpose-driven approach to organizations. And last time we talked about like this global HR initiative that you started benefiting some of the nonprofits. Can you share some news around that or what's happening from the last time we talked?
Yeah, thanks so much. And thank you for the kind words. I don't know that I fully deserve them. We had the conversation when we talked last time, which is my experience and my decision is anchored in the 20 years experience that I had in the corporate world. And if I look back at that with a degree of kind of sober reflection, I can discern that I spent largely the first 20 years of my life in the corporate world in service to myself. And that I made a lot of decisions in the interest of advancing my professional career and my professional ambitions at the expense of the people around me, my relationships, my family, my friends, my health, And I made a lot of decisions that I would probably do differently again if I could go back and change them. Mm-hmm. In saying that, I did have the benefit of experiencing a lot of professional success early in my career. I was a Fortune 500 executive at 31, and I had all the things that you would expect from a material perspective, cars, houses, trips, that at the time I thought meant a lot. And one of the big awakenings I had going through my journey, I was fortunate that I was blessed with a number of mentors around me who saw something in me and were very generous with their feedback. And I had one in particular who kind of gave me a bit of a warning call, insofar as he saw similarities in terms of how we operated, how both of us had put our career first and really kind of overridden self-care and kind of ignored the signals that our body and our friends and our families were telling us. And he laid out a very bleak future if I wasn't going to make a change around that. And I asked myself, why am I doing this? And I came to the realization that this proverbial top of the mountain that I was working so hard to get to, there's no top of the mountain. There's just only more mountain. And when I realized the amount of wreckage that I was leaving behind me in pursuit of a goal that wasn't reality and largely in service to myself, I knew I had to make a change around that. And I knew I had the opportunity because I had built skills in the corporate world to be able to do large scale change and to be able to affect large projects and help organizations achieve very large results. And I knew that I could offer those services in the market, but instead of doing it in service to a share price or to my bank account, I could offer the same services in the market, charge market rates, help my organization grow, help organizations have more success. And then with the additional money we're able to make, then we reinvest that back into society into two areas that are important to me. The first one is mental health advocacy, and the second one is supporting women entrepreneurs. And they're each important to me for their own reason. Mental health advocacy is personally important. I've struggled with mental health issues for most of my life, primarily anxiety. And it showed up in a lot of different ways, from ADHD as a teenager and not being able to read and concentrate and study in high school. So I had to learn to get very good at thinking on my feet and being involved in conversations and doing presentations and finding other ways to demonstrate that I'd retained the knowledge, because I wasn't going to read all the assignments and I wasn't going to memorize all the course content. So that was, you know, that was one thing that kind of stood out from that perspective. And when I look at the legacy I want to leave going forward, to me, it's one that includes giving back and using the skills that I built in service to somebody other than myself. So when we go out to the market and we start to negotiate against our competition and we work with clients, we start to give back in those areas. And, I understood that the impact that mental health has had in my life, I've seen the impact of it in the people around me. An underrepresented and underdiscussed stat in my perspective is the growing rates of suicide in certain jurisdictions around the world. That's a problem I think we need to talk about. I think it's a symptom of a larger societal architecture that exploits certain segments of the population for the benefit of a few people. And I think that there's an increasing energy around changing that dynamic and not moving to another extreme, but just moving incrementally back to where people can start to enjoy success, where there's an economy out there where people can contribute in a meaningful way and start to have success and not feel like they're working really hard to lose ground. So we try and do that. We know mental health becomes a significant barrier to people. I remember a number of days where I would have to, you know, couldn't go to work or would only go to work for half a day or couldn't be productive because I couldn't concentrate or I couldn't get over anxious, you know, issues, or I had a panic attack. You know, once I was able to get my arms wrapped around my mental health and take that problem seriously and see therapists and get the right kind of people around me in my network, the amount of productivity I was able to personally gain was monumental. And when I look back at the things that I was able to achieve with the help of others and organizations with anxiety, I said, wow, if I could do that with that around my neck, then I can do a lot more when this is away from me. That combined with the fact that I have a strong belief in women entrepreneurs. I've worked primarily in HR, which has meant that I've worked primarily with strong women leaders. And I've seen a number of examples where their individual and collective contributions to organizations weren't recognized, either as a function of they weren't, you know, comfortable stepping into the spotlight and owning their successes, or other people in the organization deliberately worked around them. And I didn't think that was fair and didn't think that was right. Studies have consistently shown that when you have organizations and boards that have consistent representation of diversity and inclusion, including women, they perform better. And that's not a subjective, you know, moral statement. That's pure science, pure facts. It's been proven time and time again. And I'm in interest of helping women have greater impact in society by helping them achieve the economic means to have that impact. So yes, I can help them have a voice, and that's important, but the voice to me needs to come with the credibility of being able to contribute into a broader economic context. I want to see them build organizations in their vision. So I want to create an opportunity for them to have success, to create more human-centric organizations, to grow in their careers, to contribute, and we're going to be able to provide resources and support as they seek to do that.
That's amazing. I mean, you know, two causes that are very close to your heart, and I'm sure you remember some of the conversations you and I had. I think when it comes to anxiety and mental health aspect, nobody likes to be vulnerable and share these with you know, people around them. And I think having a conversation around how somebody's going through, you know, like an honest conversation, would really help. And you know, thank you for being there when I messaged you or when we talked about what I was going through. It definitely helped, like, you know, okay, I can approach somebody that I know and that I can trust. And going to your Women Entrepreneur Initiative, I know you did your MBA in four different cities, and there was some inspiration from there as well. Can we talk something around that?
Yeah, of course. You're welcome with respect to the support. I think one thing I would just say to people right now, when you're listening to this, it'll be after the global pandemic has struck most of us. And I've been asking myself this question a lot lately, which is, if not now, then when? I think that applies as well to vulnerability right now. Mm-hmm. Nobody had a really good plan for this, and everyone is doing the best that they can. There are people who are experiencing significant tragedies, loss of jobs, loss of family, loss of friends, challenges with mental health, challenges with diet, challenges with their living situations. There's lots of people that are going through a lot of challenges. And I want to be sensitive to the fact that that's still very much present. For us, as we think about our go forward, you're right. A lot of what where we started from and a lot of where we spend our time in the market is trying to be global in nature, because the MBA for me was very much a inflection point on this kind of personal transformation, which has probably not so coincidentally been in parallel with the professional transformation as the company and I have kind of grown together. From a personal perspective, I was in a classroom in Sao Paulo, Brazil. It was the second residency of four. We had done the first year of our MBA was based in Vancouver, and the second year was an international MBA. And myself and 11 other students from Canada were part of a cohort of about 48 students from four countries around the world, Canada, the US, Brazil, and Mexico City. And we rotated through four cities during the course of that year in teams of five or six, and worked on projects together, and had to work through the complexities of managing and working with a remote team. We would, you know, have projects, we'd rotate responsibilities, we would be in service to consulting projects or school assignments. And it was a really cool experience, not only have to work in that kind of setting, but also to have exposure and immersion in three different cultures for an extended period of time. With Brazil being the first of the three internationally, because Vancouver was our first stop, it was by far the most jarring of the cultures when compared to Canada, and in the best way possible for me. I really enjoyed the passion and the commitment to relationships that I saw in the Latin American culture. I really enjoyed the enthusiasm in which they pursued essentially everything in their lives, whether it was football or business or relationships or friends and family. Like, I really liked that because my experience, you know, in North America is primarily that people kind of keep a lot, you know, to themselves, that they show a different side of themselves at business and a different side of themselves in the person, in personal life. And I didn't see that same kind of dissonance in Latin America. I'm sure it's there, but I saw less of a difference between kind of that inside voice, outside voice. And I found myself in Sao Paulo in a classroom that we were sitting through a presentation from a group of students from a program called Cap Jovem, university entrance prep program. So these kids are 16, 17 years old, and they'd come from underprivileged areas within 3 hours of the university. And the program was in service to helping them reverse a pretty challenging dynamic. In Brazil, their education system is set up in such a way that high school is public and private, university is public. So the way it goes is if you have money in your family, you send your kid to private high school, and then they have the best scores going into public university. So it perpetuates an income inequality issue because the people who have means go to university and the people that don't. And in those countries, getting a high school education is not going to support them and the jobs they're going to end up doing because the economy isn't as vibrant as it is in other jurisdictions like Canada and the United States. So parents are having to decide very early some tough decisions. Do I send my child to school at 10 or do I put them to work because the family needs money and we're living in abject poverty? Those are very real decisions that people are making on a day-to-day basis. And these kids are telling us stories about their personal experiences and how they've risen above those circumstances to be sitting in front of us in this university entrance prep program, knowing full well that if they succeed, that they'll go to university and be able to completely transform their entire family's lives. Because to go from the favela into a salaried position at a Brazilian-based company like Embraer, which makes, you know, medium-sized airplanes and competes with Bombardier in Canada, for example, that completely changes not only their personal circumstances, but the circumstances of their entire family around them. It can pull them out of poverty, which, as you can appreciate, is a big driving force for a lot of these students, but also a lot of pressure when you're 16 years old and when your friends haven't been as fortunate and are ostracizing you from the community because you're the one being bused 3 hours to and from school every single day to go to school to have a chance to go to university, to have a chance to get a degree, to have a chance to get a job so that 5 years from now, your family can probably get out of poverty. That's a lot for a 16-year-old kid. And something I didn't have to experience when I was 16, I had my own personal challenges growing up, but I never worried about the level of violence and the level of poverty that was present in these kids. And the way they spoke about it was with such grounding and with such passion. And they only spoke in terms of what they were going to use this for in service to other people. And I kept thinking about, here I am sitting in Brazil. I paid for an MBA in cash. I'm looking at this program in terms of how I'm going to advance my own career. And then I'm sitting in front of these students who are 16 years old talking about how they can help people and change the world. And I couldn't have felt worse about myself. I became incredibly emotional. I had to leave the class. And I stepped outside and said, I don't know what this means, but I know I can't leave Sao Paulo going back to my job and viewing the world the same way. And that I have to be in service to other people. And if nothing else, because that's exactly what I think I have the privilege of having been put in a position to be able to do. And I've certainly enriched myself for long enough. For me now, it's about how can I help other people? And that largely started in Brazil.
It's amazing, like, you know, how life shows the way, ways to improve other people's lives and even helping ourselves, like finding our own purpose, right? And that story continuously repeated in many people's lives. You know, you're very successful and all of a sudden some new perspective shows up. I'm glad that happened and you realize there's something you can do there. And I'm glad that through Global HR Collective, you want to make a difference in those communities. Where do you see yourself moving forward with your personal situation and with Bento HR?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think we've used this opportunity for a few different things, and I've used this opportunity for a few different things to take some reflection in terms of where we are in the market and where we want to show up in the market. And I say that because we're mindful of the fact that what we do can be helpful to a lot of different organizations, regardless of their size and their geography. And when the markets reopen and organizations are attempting to solve for some of the challenges that they encountered during this period of time, I want us to be really clear in the market of what we do well at Bento HR, what the Global HR Collective is in service to, and allow customers to be able to make informed decisions around how they're going to support their organizations going forward. And that for me looks like producing a lot more thought leadership and content that is will not be paid content. It will be all free. It'll be in service to the broader audience. And one thing I would just say, touching back on your previous point, the journey to get to this point was created because among a million other things like chance and luck and good fortune and the people around me, it started with the willingness to put myself in an opportunity to have that kind of experience. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what the MBA was going to mean for me, but I knew that I would get something from the experience if I looked hard enough. And maybe it was confirmation bias. Maybe I was primed for that kind of values shift, but if I hadn't have done the MBA, I probably wouldn't have had the revelation. I probably would be in a corporation right now, not that much happier. Probably wouldn't be having this chat. So for those people saying, well, I haven't had that kind of transcendent moment, okay, I get it. And you won't unless you put yourself in opportunities to be uncomfortable and to learn and to have that illumination exist. And then don't be surprised when it happens, because when you get bit with that bug, it's super exciting, and you get up every morning excited to be able to work towards a goal that's in service to other people. And I know you know that feeling as well. And the opportunity to balance that with self-care for me is really important, because I know that my happiness is tied directly to how I treat myself as much as it is about my professional success. So I've been spending lots of time doing meditation and yoga and writing, all things that bring me a lot of joy. And I now have time for that, which I didn't have time for it before. I've made that time, made that investment. That's what I get from this. I don't need a large paycheck or a fancy car in my driveway. What I need to know is that I'm helping people, that I'm learning, and that I'm being in service to other people, that I'm solving complex problems, and that I have time along the way to find some peace and find some calm and find some opportunities for creative outlets. That to me is much more important than my T4 state.
Isn't that amazing? Like, once you find the tranquility, you just never want to go back. I'm so glad that we could connect and record this for, you know, everyone to watch and learn.
Just one thing I want to share. You know me enough to know that I have a strong bias for action.
Yeah.
And that I really like to kind of get to brass tacks, because I think the conversation is illuminating and it's inspirational. And then when it's paired with action, it's unstoppable. And I think that this opportunity that's in front of us for the majority of people is that they have more time in their schedule for something. And I'm not here to pass any judgment on what they choose to do with their time. That's their decision. But cool. I want to illuminate for people that they have the opportunity now where, I don't know about you, but for many times in the last 38 years of my life, I've used the excuse, if only I had more time, .. Mm-hmm. And that's why I've been asking myself, if not now, then when? I've been working really hard to say, hey, if I'm able to build the life that I want to live, it's going to have to come with some trade-off decisions. I'm going to have to make investments in certain parts of my balance portfolio, if you will. And there's no possible way that I've been able to put my head wrapped around that you can have absolutely everything. You're going to have to eventually make a trade-off decision somewhere in your life. And that may mean that you work 50 hours a week and have a really good work-life balance with your family, and that works for you. But it may, if you're not motivated by work, that may mean you work part-time and you make less money, or you have more passive recurring revenue, so you have more time to spend with your family, not so financially motivated. Or maybe you choose not to have a family at all and spend more time at work. There's not a right or wrong. I know there's a lot of societal pressures and familial pressures and friend pressures, but I think it's really empowering to be able to say, this is the way I want my life to look. Mm-hmm. And then what steps am I willing to take to kind of realize this? And the things that I use on my scorecard, just for those who are curious, I use professional, because I need to earn money. I'm in a position where I have to earn money to support my lifestyle and support the charitable initiatives that we have, you know, working with us. I try and be in service to broader society. So that for me can look like volunteering my time. It could be look like there are charitable activities, but I try to be in service to other people. It looks like an opportunity for relationships. And that means family, friends, just really investing in the intentionality behind those relationships and having a select few, but the ones that are really deep and meaningful. Mm-hmm. And to focus in on your health, which for me, I define as mental health and physical health, as diet, that's nutrition. I've made some significant changes around my diet in this trip because I needed to get away and be able to focus on putting the right things in my body to ensure I was at my best performance and able to show up. It's meditation, it's mindfulness. I've built that as I encourage others to do, but that's my schedule. That may not work for other people. Build your own and be mindful about the things you put into it. I think that is a great starting point and at least forces the conversation on having to make trade-off decisions or where are you now and where do you want to be, and then reverse engineering how do you get there. That piece for me was a big game changer, was just kind of building out that plan. Illuminates a lot of really important questions and discussions. So I would encourage people to take the opportunity to do that.
For anybody watching these videos, the intention is there is knowledge out there and it doesn't probably apply to your situation or may apply. We don't know that, but sharing the knowledge, allowing us to see what other people are doing in their life, given the current situation, and also how they're planning their life journey as a whole, right? And you're totally right, like on the diet and nutrition and then mental health aspect, like how you're using meditation and yoga in your life. And it changes from person to person. And there is no perfect way of saying this is how it needs to be. And if you're not doing it, you're doing it wrong. That doesn't work. I mean, personally, that never worked for me. You know, really hoping like there are people who inspire from it and they start doing some of these initiatives that we are doing, like, you know, sharing the knowledge, sharing the content. What can they do in their life to empower other people or even stop thinking about how they can transform and make a difference in the community, in the workplace, and in their personal life? So I'm really glad that we had this conversation. Thank you so much.
You too, my friend. Enjoy. If you need anything else, let me know. I'm around.